Hey guys, I want to talk to you about another great podcast called Who Charted. They're also in the Earwolf family, and they have an Earwolf favorite on their latest episode. It's Jason Mantzoukas. He's absolutely freaking hilarious, obviously, from How Did This Get Made and other stuff. He's just a very funny person. So in each episode of Who Charted, Howard Kremer and Kulap Vilaysack sit down with a comedian guest to talk about what's charting in music and movies. And on this new episode, like I mentioned, they have Jason Mantzoukas, who is just really freaking hilarious. You probably know him from the FX show The League, his frequent and hilarious guest appearances on Earwolf's comedy Bang Bang, and also as co-host of the Earwolf podcast, How Did This Get Made? So subscribe to Who Charted on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Cracked Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Tom Ryman.
And we are Cracked's movie experts. We're here to tell you about some neat behind-the-scenes details about your favorite films.
Neat.
Neat. I like that word. I'm trying to bring it back.
It's neat.
Neat. You know, it's so wholesome, that word. For the next hour, we're going to dissect 2012's Zero Dark Thirty, directed by Kathryn Bigelow. Along with us is our guest, Teresa Lee.
Hello, what's up?
So before we begin, what we like to do is we like to have our guest kind of give a short synopsis of the film. First off, when was the first time that you watched this movie?
I just watched it for the first time.
Get out of town.
Tuesday night.
Same here.
I'm the only one who watched this.
Yeah.
It was really good. I think I remember when it came out, it was on my list of, because it was, you know, what was during the award season. I was like, I got to watch all these movies.
Right.
But then I always... There's too many, and then I put it off, and then I don't.
Well, it was, yeah, for me, like, it just, I just wasn't interested for whatever reason. It was just like, oh, I don't, it felt too immediate to me.
Yeah.
There was a lot of war films in, like, the previous 3 years.
Well, it was just like, that had just happened.
Right.
And it was like, I remember the news reports very clearly for Osama being killed. Like, I don't need to watch a movie about it. But, I mean, which was foolish of me because it's like you go watch and say, oh, this is an amazing movie.
It's also a very moody movie, so you it's not like a put it on while you're eating spaghetti.
No. Your spaghetti will get cold.
This is when I watch most of my movies.
You'll just kind of, like, put the fork down slowly.
I love that. Just, like, go-to food for you.
Because it
just
starts right off with just with Jason Clark's
intense.
Beating the shit out of this guy.
Yeah.
Like, you can't eat to that.
Yeah.
Where were you when... Do you remember where you were when you found out Osama was killed?
I was sitting in my apartment in Portsmouth, Virginia.
I remember I was working on my college thesis, and I hadn't slept. And I was just... I was an RA, so I went to the RA office, and I, like, go there... The news was on, and everyone started texting. I was like, what's going on? And people were screaming outside.
Yeah, I was not the worst situation, but I was on a date. And it was on the TV, and we both went like, oh. And it was like
and
our
you were
second
like,
date.
I did that. That was me.
Yeah, I was like, by the way, I'm Chris Pratt. soon to be famous.
Did that help or hurt the date?
It did not help. Because all we did is we were like, oh. And then we were like... How do we feel about, like, I had to segue it because I can't help myself to be like, well, what's the most interesting conversation to come out of this?
Right.
And the most interesting conversation is, like, is it a good thing that we celebrate murder?
Right, you know? It was weird to, it was definitely jarring to see people celebrating.
Yeah,
it was
like, but at the same time, it was like, okay, it's justified for, like, just war reasons, but at the same time, you're like, I don't know if I like it.
I mean, was it? Right, I mean, it was super illegal.
I feel like it's more like a, like, okay, like, maybe a feeling relieved is okay. I feel like just straight out cheering is always weird when someone dies. But people did that when that judge died, right?
Or,
Antonin Scalia.
Oh. They were like, ding dong, the witch is dead.
That's pretty fucked up.
Just dying in general seems weird to cheer about.
Yeah. Like, I remember looking at, like, footage of, I think it was people at UVA. One of the biggest colleges that was close to me and where I was living in Virginia. And it was, you know, people like going like, woo, you know, like block party outside because Osama's dead. I was like, fuck that guy. But like, that feels weird. Like, I don't, like I just sat there on my couch being like, how do I feel about this? Like, on the one hand, fuck that dude. But on the other hand, that's weird.
Yeah.
It was just...
Celebrating death is, like, a pretty rough thing to get your mind around.
It also felt weird just because it was, like... It was 2011, right? So it had been, like, 10 years since September 11th. So it was... And we hadn't heard anything about Osama in years at that point.
Yeah.
Like, he was pretty hidden. So it was like, oh, So it's like when like Mary J. Blige comes out with a new album, you're like, oh.
Yeah, it was like, oh, you're still working on that. Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah, okay.
Oh, it's been like 4 years, but yeah, all right. Ooh. Like,
terrible. No, that's, I actually think that's a very good start to this podcast because, as we'll find as we deep dive, this movie is very ambiguous about how it feels about this topic. You know?
Right, yeah. It's like about... it's like that feeling we just talked about for 2.5 hours.
Exactly. It's more about the end of a chapter of American history and world history, arguably, but less about how the cultural response was justifiable or not, how we're supposed to feel about it morally, and more about just here's the things that happened. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's Hollywood, so it's not going to be exactly correct, but I think as far as propagandist war films go, pretty centered.
Right, because it did feel, I mean, I think I felt this way with Hurt Locker too, and even though, like, I think Christian, one of the correct writers, has debunked it. Yeah, but it did feel like it was more realistic because it didn't take a side, and it wasn't, it felt more, it was like trying to show you a slice of what you would actually see.
Yeah,
and I think, well, this one had more of a, because Hurt Locker was a piece of fiction that was just like meant to be, this is the tone of the Iraq War, so I think it took a little more liberties.
Whereas
this one is like, this is about actual events.
Let's segue.
So it starts where Maya is in this new camp in Pakistan, I believe, and she has to watch torture. And at first you're like, oh, she's a girl, so she's not going to do well. But then she's like, no, I want him to see me. So she takes off her thing and she's like, I'm going in. And then you're like, okay, this is clearly going to be a badass lady. So basically the whole movie is like her working on killing Osama and nobody believing her because they're like, I mean, it's not, I don't think they totally play up the sexist thing because there's other women that work there, but they definitely have motifs where they like show the difference in like gender dynamics there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Her other female coworker, they really play up like she wants to serve cake. Like they really like play up the themes of like gender there. And she's sort of in the middle and she's also like, I'm a lone wolf. I just want to kill Osama. I have no friends and no family and I don't like to fuck. And then she...
fucking.
That's the thing. She said,
zero
she's like, I'm not going to fuck. I'm not a woman who fucks.
No, there's no love interest. Yeah. It's not needed.
And so she's still doing that. And then she works really, really hard and kind of puts it all together, stalks this one messenger guy and finds Osama. And then she sends in Chris Pratt. And his friends.
Chris Pratt and friends. Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
That's a great way of describing Marines. Just well, one guy and his friend.
They're SEALs,
one guy
right?
And his friends.
Yeah, I guess there are SEALs. Yeah, you're right about that.
And they all go in, crash a copter, kill a bunch of women and some men. Way more people than they thought. There were only supposed to be three men.
To be three men and three women,
three women,
and I think
like two kids.
And there was,
and there
like
were like
way more.
200 kids in there. And they,
Osama was running an orphanage.
Then they murder him, and then that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
All right.
That is a great sum up.
That is a list of things that happened.
No, I'm super excited about that sum up because
it had
the appropriate amount of commentary while it's telling us. We like to follow up with a few of our own horrible summaries. Feel free to join us in our segment, Terrible Loglines.
Chris Pratt shoots a woman to death in her living room.
Debbie, apparently an intern, single-handedly finds Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Don't bring cake to a negotiation. Oh, wait, that's not a logline. Oh, Lauren brings cake to a negotiation and gets blown up.
Super does. Torture is awesome.
Some monkeys steal ice cream and then get sent away.
They get killed.
They get killed.
They get killed.
Yeah. They get sent away to the farm.
A Middle East statesman demands to be called the wolf.
Osama bin Laden is thwarted by a 24-hour Lamborghini dealership.
That's true. I think that concludes, unless you got another one.
Oh, I don't know. Probably not.
I love your confident unconfidence. Well, let's dive into the making of the movie in a segment we like to call Expensive Pretending.
Expensive Pretending.
So, in pre-production, the movie was originally about the unsuccessful decade-long manhunt for Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, Mark Bowles' script was primarily focusing on the Tora Bora thing.
And it was completely rewritten once he was killed.
Once Osama was killed.
Yeah, which is crazy, you know, because that was like within a year.
Yeah, it's going to be a very, very different movie.
Yeah. Something that, in an unusual step, the acting CIA director, Michael Morrill, was issued a statement about the film, emphasizing that while the production team had met with the CIA and the film is a dramatization and not historically accurate, he specifically contradicted the film's assertion that torture had been a significant benefit to locating bin Laden. So it started off with they were interviewing, they were getting like, all right, what's the rub? Like, how did we find the guy?
Yeah, and Mark Bull was apparently present in like a debriefing or something that the CIA director didn't know that Bull had been there.
Right. And it was just interesting because it's one of the first times that a movie was made so soon after an event that the CIA actually had to have like a statement that said like, this impression is false. And it's a quote, we cannot allow a Hollywood film to cloud our memory, because that's the CIA acknowledging that like people will remember not just the event, but like within a year or two, the movie that came out as more true than the actual event itself.
But that makes sense to me because we are very visual in our memory. So, yes. I mean, you might read an article about what happened and they're just names that you mostly don't know because unless you work in D.C., you probably don't know all the like high up officials and they probably try to stay private. So then you don't see much from it. And then you see this movie and it's so thorough, and even though you know it's fake, you're going to just fill in the gaps.
Well, and one of the most important images or memorable images that people have of this controversy are the photos of Abu Ghraib.
I mean, that's in a lot of ways why this film probably got, you know, greenlit, is that as a culture we had to kind of move on from that thing, you know? I mean, I think that's the thrust of why Bigelow is essentially saying, like, torture, not so good.
But they also, yeah, I would disagree that the movie takes a stance that it's good. I think because it's a plot point, it has to move it along. But it's like, I think they do a decent job of showing the other side of it. And I think I noticed throughout, it's when the people are torturing the detainees, a lot of the way they shoot it makes you feel like they're also being tortured. And there's also moments when they're like in their office and she's like rubbing her face and like, and when he's looking at the monkeys, I think they make a point to show like, oh, these people torturing are actually also being tortured by this job.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And so it's intentionally ambiguous.
And
I
they
think.
Do it on purpose, and I think they don't take a stance where it's like, see, this is good.
Right. I am of the same opinion. I don't think it takes a stance. And the fact that there were people on both sides of the argument that insisted that it simultaneously insisting that it's both pro and anti torture to me indicates that it just kind of presents it.
Yeah,
and we'll definitely get into that in the second half of the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Jessica Chastain's character, Maya, is a composite character, but was primarily provoked by a report that Mark Bull had heard of a female CIA liaison who was on the ground that night bin Laden was killed. And I forget what her code name was, something like Beth or something. That's the only thing that the SEALs knew her as.
That's super cool.
And he had also heard about a female agent who had been recruited out of college. And that is a CIA agent named Alfreda Frances Bukowski, who is also known as the Unidentified Queen of Torture.
Yeah.
She's a lady who is infamous, and you can read about her online, but she's known as the Unidentified Queen of Torture because she's been implicated indirectly in a lot of like reports about enhanced interrogation that's sort of gone like over the edge or too far, and there's a lot of reports that don't mention her by name, but they mention this female CIA agent who people agree is her, and not a lot of that translates into Chastain's character in the film, because in the movie she's not, like you were saying up top, she's not like, she doesn't enjoy hurting people, she just uses it as a tool, like she's fine with, like you'll see in some scenes, like when she's talking to the one guy, she just kind of nudges the dude that's in the room with her and he reaches over and smacks the guy in the face. But she doesn't like relish it. She just is like, this is a tool that I need to get to the next
step
of the investigation.
They have her look away when in the first scene when he pulls the pants
scene,
down.
In the first scene, they make
so
you,
so you know, like she's not like into it, but she will do what she has to do.
That's the only time she does it though. It's when you first meet her. And I think it's to sort of give you like an ambiguity.
Well, they also want you to like her, I think.
Right. But then as soon as Jason Clark leaves the room, she's like, fuck you. Like, you can help yourself. because he's going to get back in here and wail on you. So you start talking to us, and maybe he won't. But yeah, so she's based on a couple of real people, including like this ghoul, apparently.
Yeah.
Or like one of the infamous stories about her is that she flew a very long distance just to be in the room for the torture of a Al-Qaeda operative.
Yeah. Like and she had been involved. Bukowski was like in the, she started off in CIA in the 90s doing like Soviet, you know, insurgency. And then she started investigating because there was a, in 2000, the USS Cole bombing. And then she was promoted to deputy chief of the Bin Laden Issue Station, which is the actual name of it. The Bin Laden Issue Station. And by March 2003, she had been appointed chief of that station.
Sounds like a sitcom, like a NBC sitcom.
Yeah,
like,
the Bin Laden
what
issue.
What are we going to do issue. About the Bin Laden issue?
Like the Mindy Project?
Yeah.
The Bin Laden issue.
But yeah, so she had been in, for a decade or so, she had already been in the Middle East. And like, so she was not even, she wasn't thought of as the person to elect to the position, but because of her, you know, like torture, she's known as like a torture apologist. So they were like, yeah, you're a fake.
And like super into it.
Yeah.
She's present for tortures, hence, enhanced interrogations that she did not need to be present for. She just like was sitting there eating popcorn.
Hence the moniker.
Right. Yeah.
How do you apply for a job like that? Like to be like, I've got, here's all my torture. Like, do you have a torture portfolio? Like a torture folio?
I think torture folio. I think you just kind of start doing it. And then like the other people just start taking notes. Like, she's really good at this.
Here's my reel.
Yeah. Here's my reel.
Here's my reel. Look at all the torture.
Okay, so I conflated the two then. There was a separate woman that Mark Bull had heard of who was recruited out of college and had spent her entire career on Bin Laden's manhunt. Bukowski actually predates that because you said she was working for the CIA since the 90s. Okay.
But she was in the media at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So she actually, she was like an available, like pull for Bull. Mark Bull.
Oh, man. Mark Bull... He looks like the handsome bandit from Westworld.
Yeah, we talked about this last time.
He's just like he
way too young.
Yeah, he's way too young to be doing like he's done like every Bigelow film since the Catherine Bigelow Renaissance. He looks like the handsome bandit from Westworld.
I didn't know what Spike Jonze looked like, and then once maybe like 5 years ago or something, I remember. Oh, I think it was for when her won awards. I saw him. Oh, yeah, he's cute. Yeah, okay.
So
he kind of looks like, oh, his hair kind of looks like Andrew Garfield.
He's got like a Jon Snow like, thing going, right?
Yeah.
He's worked on pretty much every, he wrote The Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty. He wrote Detroit that's just come out.
Yeah.
Because we never see these faces, and then we see them at war shows, and you're like, whoa, put these guys on camera.
Yeah, it's just crazy. He was born in 1973, so he's 44 right now. But Hurt Locker came out, when is it again?
2009. Well, 2008 was when it...
Yeah, but he wrote it in like 2000... He went and studied it for it like in 2004 or 5, right? Is that what we said last podcast? Everything just falls out of my brain once we've talked about
it. So yeah, like it's just... It's been this decade-long collaboration now between him and Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah.
Been very, very fruitful for them both.
Mm-hmm. Right. I want to talk about casting because there's a few moments of cool things. Chris Pratt... who actually has a small role in this, but arguably because he got like super swole for this film, that there everyone like he became.
This is absolutely why he's a superhero and a big star.
Wait, did he do Guardians before? Or did he
No, he did Guardians after this. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he got fit for this film because he was like, I gotta be
in this. I thought he was doing Guardians and then. That's why he got all big, and because they had to like justify it.
He got bigger, but
but it was for this film, and I remember
that he turned into Flabby, you know, Andy.
Yeah, I remember it was during the production of this movie. Like he had like an Instagram post come out that was him at the gym, and everyone was like, "Whoa!"
Yeah, the internet as a whole was like, "Are you kidding me?"
Yeah,
but he went through vigorous training in order to do this, as you would assume. He went through literally boot camp to prepare for the role.
I imagine the other SEALs probably did too. Like Joel Edgerton is the other main one. And then you like briefly see Frank Grillo, who has also been in Marvel movies. He was Crossbones in Captain America.
Well, the funny thing about that, though, because it seems like such a big role, and I was waiting for Chris Pratt to come on, and he was at the end.
That's all third act,
Most of it's like you can barely see them. It's all in the dark, their bodies. It's like, imagine being your big break, like being like, oh, well, like one of those other guys, and you're like, oh, I'm cast in this huge movie, and then most of it's like, who are you?
Yes.
It's all just darkness. I mean, I guess the voices of the main actors you can hear, but you don't see much acting in there. It's all shadows moving through the dark.
Sure. I think that's intentional. We'll definitely
It's for sure intentional for filmmaking, but as an actor being like, oh, I got my stage time. It's like, no, those could be extras for all.
Right.
For
yeah.
All
there
you
are
care.
A couple of moments where the main guys backwards. Pull their masks up to say a couple of lines. You're like, well, that's just Hollywood. Like, because SEALs wouldn't
take
do that.
It off.
Like,
no. They also would up. Communicate via comms. They wouldn't say, like, hey, what's up, buddy?
He was diabolical, too, Chris Pratt. Like, he kept every room that they got into, he would start saying the target's name.
Right, he said their name.
And he did it for, like, everyone. I was like, that's some fucking Predator shit.
Yeah.
Like, the Predator playing his, like, recorded voice calls.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're diabolical, Chris Pratt.
And he's always right. That's what didn't make sense to me. I'm like, how do you know who's in the room? It could be any. You should name all of them. And then he was always right. He'd say the name, and then he'd kill them, and then it was right.
Well, because I think
it's shock and awe tactic.
He's, like, calling
They knew the three targets they were going for. They kill the first guy immediately when they come into the door. So the second guy, he's just saying the second guy's name because they're going to assume Osama's on the third floor.
Mm. Right.
Tom Hardy, Idris Elba, Guy Pearce, Rooney Mara were all considered for different roles. Obviously, Mara for
I think
Jessica
she was,
Chastain's role. Maya.
Wasn't she briefly cast?
I think they actually went through the casting process with her. Hardy was eventually replaced by Mark Strong.
Really? Tom Hardy was going to play Mark Strong's character?
Yeah. Which I actually think is like they're kind of a good fit because they're both like kind of like... I don't know. They have a history of playing like rough and tumble, you know.
Yeah.
Mark Strong's got that tooth, you know. Like
wasn't really on display in this. I was looking for his tooth.
Yeah.
Wasn't really on display.
Much more on display in like the Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
Film.
His hairpiece was incredible.
That
And he does have a British rough and tumble scowl off with Stannis in the hallway.
Yeah.
Stannis Baratheon was one of the other.
But yeah, Guy Pearce would have been interesting just because...
Was Guy Pearce going to be for the Mark Strong character as well?
I don't know.
He could have fit
not
for that.
On, but he was just considered. I think it's just because Bigelow loves Guy Pearce.
I could see him as the Jason Clark part.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. And I could see the same thing for Idris Elba.
Oh, yeah.
Because he would be pretty imposing. Yeah. But yeah, who's on the team? Notable crew members, as we mentioned, Mark Bolesback. But the writer, director, producer, and many of the production crew... all worked on The Hurt Locker. So it was almost like Chapter 2, The War.
Pretty much, yeah. This was her follow-up to The Hurt Locker, the first movie she did after winning Best Director and having Hurt Locker get all the other awards.
And James Cameron, again, was in negotiations to direct the film but dropped out to produce Avatar 2, which is coming out in 2020, by the way.
Dick. Stupid dickhead.
Yeah, he just passed on an entire decade.
No, but if he had, I feel like if James Cameron had directed, there would just be like a long like makeout scene, and like it would just have been totally different. The music, there would have been like orchestral music.
Yeah, it
like,
would have been less grassroots
been
kind of like
Definitely
style.
The music. I'm glad you mentioned it because I wanted to bring that up again. Like Hurt Locker, it's very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there's not a lot of score in the movie. There's not a lot of music, period. But definitely very little score.
It's usually, as we mentioned last podcast, like source, like coming from a radio. Mm-hmm.
Right. The only piece of score I can remember is when the two helicopters are flying into Osama's compound.
What is it with Hollywood and helicopters and war and like music? Like we, since Apocalypse Now.
Since
just
Apocalypse
like,
Now, man.
Yeah.
We're just like, that's
do
war.
It. Like.
Yeah.
That's what war looks like.
No director
and sounds
ever,
like.
Yeah, no director ever shied away of like, what is this sequence of helicopters flying around during wartime? I just don't think that there should be any music. You know, like no director ever said that.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that there's no, for the entire, I mean, the entire third act is essentially the raid on Osama's compound. No music.
No music at
Completely
all.
Completely quiet except for what's going
because
on. And that is such, even it was interesting that it was, she's so good at tension because that sequence is very tense, even though if you are old enough, like we all are, to remember when it happened, you know that none of the servicemen get killed. None of the soldiers die.
No.
Mm-hmm. And you know that the operation was a success, even though they crash a helicopter.
Yeah.
So you know none of the characters are actually in danger, but the movie is made. It's just she's just so good at
yeah.
moving all those parts.
Not only just because I think that she definitely took delicate hand, and the editors took delicate hand in terms of, like, the fact that it was a cultural moment. But, like, just like there's no music, and she was very adamant about the verisimilitude of, like, it feeling like a documentary or like you're a fly on the wall. I also wanted to point out that, like, you notice you never see Osama bin Laden's face. You see his feet, you see, like, his beard. But, like, it's almost like he's just an afterthought of the event, even though he is the main deal.
It's all leading up to that.
And I think that that is all kind of Bigelow saying, like, yeah, it's a huge moment, but I'm not going to, like infuse my, like, version of it onto the audience.
I think it's twofold in it, like what you're saying, an attempt to not be exploitative.
Yeah.
And then also it serves a metaphorical narrative purpose.
Yes, absolutely.
Which we'll definitely talk about when we get to that part.
Yeah.
Well, you also said it's like a documentary, which I noticed too, because of the way they, like, the no music helps with that, because you sort of feel like it's like more like news or real. And then you also have all the chapters that it almost feels like a briefing, you know, like a CIA doc or something, the way it's, there's like chapters.
Speaking of authenticity, moving to production, there's a lot of things just like in Hurt Locker that, like, those bizarre four lens night vision goggles worn by the SEALs in that act.
Yeah.
SEAL Team 6 are in fact authentic. That's what they wear. They're cutting edge ground panoramic night vision goggles. So they allow you to see more peripheral.
Oh, word. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
So that's why there's four.
I was wondering. Yeah. I was like, I assumed that they wouldn't make something like that up because it looks so crazy. You're just like, wow. what those dudes are in on their faces.
It just looks like, all right, you're just throwing a, you know, like more lenses, you know, just like how we have a lightsaber now that has like 18 different directions, you know, like it just seems like we got to make these more badass. No, that's real. And that's the kind of thing that Bigelow always brings to these projects, or at least in the Hurt Locker. They shot again in Jordan to mimic the rest of the Middle East because that's a safe area.
Parts of it, yeah.
Parts of it, yeah.
And they shot some stuff in India, which created a problem, incidentally, because they were using India to double as Pakistan. And some locals really seriously objected to that. And then the same thing happened when they filmed that brief, really brief sequence in Gdansk in Poland. I hope I'm saying that correctly. but Poland was really upset by it. It's a scene when Jessica Chastain goes to talk to one of the operatives that later becomes a bigger character, and the guy's like handcuffed to the table. Poland was upset about that, or the city was at least, because they didn't like the insinuation that their city was the location of a CIA black site.
Oof.
They were upset by that.
That makes a lot of sense, though. I mean,
maybe
you shouldn't have a CIA black site there.
Yeah, because that's what this city in Poland will be remembered by.
Right.
Which I just heard of, and I don't know how to pronounce.
Still can't pronounce it.
Yeah. Shot digital, footage equivalent to 1.8 million feet of film.
Yeah, same thing as Hurt Locker. Yeah, Hurt Locker shot over a million feet of film.
Yep, as we spoke about last time, Hurt Locker challenged Apocalypse Now in its footage. This one beats both of them. Co-editor William Goldenberg estimated that 1/8 of the total footage was on the assault itself. Just that 20-minute sequence.
We know they had to shoot it at least twice because there's regular moonlit footage, and then also the night vision footage. Yeah. They shot it at least twice. I had read that it may have been four times. Twice for each.
Which is just crazy. I mean, that's throwing a lot of time and effort, and there's explosions, and that's a lot of money.
It's like a 30-minute sequence. It's a long sequence.
Yeah, it's at least 20. And but, like, the brunt of it is, like, walking through doors and shining lights on people and objects, which, you know, you could shoot that run and gun and make it pretty cheap, but they chose to give 1/8 of the production toward it, which is just kind of unheard of. But I think it's because she knew that she wanted to overcover it, because she knew this is a cultural moment. I can't fuck this up.
What? Right. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, no, I was going to make a dumb joke that now I don't want to make.
No, make it. Make it.
I was just going to say, why can't she could have just played one of those Black Ops video games and, you know, like on Twitch and just downloaded it.
Yes,
that's actually, save some time.
That's actually really interesting you mentioned that, because I want to just jump quickly to the marketing of the film, which is EA promoted Zero Dark Thirty in a video game. in the new installment of Medal of Honor, Warfighter is what it's called. And they offer downloadable maps of locations depicted in the film.
Whoa.
So it's like a, you know, we've always talked about how, like, you know, Call of Duty and all these, like, war games are, like, the best recruitment for, you know, the Army and, like, mm-hmm. the Marines ever. But this is, like... This is pretty literal. This is pretty, like, yeah. Do you like killing Osama
bin Laden? Like, yeah.
They were like, we're giving a dollar of each download to veterans' causes, but it's still like, this is very exploitative.
Yeah, and, like, and I think you
I think this is the exact opposite of the thesis of the film.
Yeah.
So if you were in that mission and you had, like, if you're, like, just, like, wanted to reminisce, you could just... play the game with your buddies and be like, it's just like the old days.
Well, Kumail Nanjiani has a really great bit talking about playing Call of Duty because there's a map in one of the Call of Duty games that's based on Karachi, which is where he grew up.
Whoa.
So it's like he's playing this game. It's like, I fucking know these streets. Like,
that's cool. Yeah. Oh, they should make video games for your memories. So you could, like just one of my, you know, like, you know, high school homecoming or something. And I just play it. And not that I want to relive homecoming. A good memory.
You know what's sad is as soon as you said that, I immediately thought, like, what game would I play? I was like, I'm going to play the, you know, like a month ago when I had that really good sleep.
Yeah, I guess high school would mostly be me sitting at home doing homework, but I'd play that game.
Yeah.
I'd play the game of the one time I got a base hit in Little League, and then after that game, I got to go see Batman Returns. That was a good day.
A fun game.
We got a whole lot of insecurities flying around right now.
Before we move on from production, I wanted to say that it's interesting that the movie is bookended by two major, major cultural events because it begins with 9/11, but you don't see any footage, which I thought was a really interesting choice. And then she actually got Bigelow got into a little bit of legal trouble for it because she used. Sound. She just used a series of sound clips against a black screen to show us September 11th.
Right. And the calls. Yeah.
Because she used some of the calls that people had made, the families of, I think, two of those, of the people whose calls were featured, were upset and, I believe, sued the production over it.
Right. Oh, wow.
But that, notwithstanding, it was interesting that she didn't show it.
I thought it was super effective because there had already been, like, United 93.
Yeah.
There had already been, you know, several films that were, like, really jumped into the, you know,
but not,
emotion,
it was,
emotive response.
It was interesting that she didn't even show news footage. She just was just a black screen. And then the end of the movie is the raid on Osama's compound, which almost takes place in real time.
Yeah, it's like the reverse of that. It's like trying to show everything as if you're really there.
Yeah, I had read that the duration of the sequence in the film is almost exactly the duration of the actual mission.
The mission. Oh, wow. I mean, that's pretty bold. I'll say that.
Yeah.
It goes with what you were saying about not wanting to mix up, like, the Hollywood imagery with actual news footage, because I think she tries to fill in gaps for her story. I mean, clearly it's like
a
movie and it's her story and it's like, you know, I guess fictional if you're gonna it's not claiming to be truthful, but it does make you believe it more because it's around real events, and then she's not redoing like even when we do see GW and Obama, there's like small, like, short clips of them on the news. We don't get actors.
They're in the background out of focus.
Right.
You feel like you're there, but they don't, like, cast actors as the president. So there's never a moment where you're like, oh, this is a... I mean, it is obviously a movie, but you could believe that it's happening around your reality.
It's trying to be, like, a hidden, like, truth of just a world you didn't see, but it exists in our world, absolutely. And speaking about, like, just, like, how, like, almost insurmountable this feat was to create a film and try to do it tastefully, a lot of the actors were American, so they also were bringing their own stuff to it. And there was, for example, Chastain took all the photos of the suspects every day after, you know, she shot and after work and in pre-production. And she actually, in her hotel room, she posted them on the wall like she was a CIA agent trying to, you know, find out a case. She thought it was something that Maya would do, you know, is just bring the photos with her wherever she is. And it's just that kind of, I think, devotion to the cause of what I think Bigelow is trying to do in this movie, which is to say, like, these are real people, but not only that, like, every movie is about real people, but, like, you have to really get in the mind of someone who is arguably doing something that is morally gray. And how do you really dissect that? How do you really, like, how does this person work? And I think there's a lot of that going on. You know, also with, what's his name? Jason Clark's character. Like, as we see that arc happen, like, I can't think of another arc that's like that with that type of character. Someone who's like, rah, 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 torture, torture, torture. And then by the end of the film is like, I'm happy behind a desk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like that.
Yeah, he retreats back to D.C.
Yeah, exactly.
The Release, nominated for a bunch of awards again.
Yeah, it was. Best Picture, Best Actress for Chastain, Best Original Screenplay, Best Film Editing, and it won the award for Best Sound Editing.
Did Catherine Bigelow get nominated again or no for this one?
No director.
No director.
Who won that year for...
Oh, that's a good question. Director.
What was it? I guess it would have been 2013.
2013's
right?
awards.
2013. Ang Lee, sorry.
Oh, yeah, for Life of Pi.
Oh, yeah.
There was some conflict about the film's release because it was going to come out in October, and there was a big outcry against that because some people assumed it was going to be a very pro-Obama film, and right. 2012 was an election year. So for that reason, and also just because they wanted to release it in awards season, they pushed the release back to December of 2012 after the election. And then, of course, you watch the movie, and it's not a pro right. any candidate.
Yeah,
it's brutal, and it's, you know, like I mentioned up top, it's criticized as being both pro torture and anti torture.
Yeah, which we'll dive into a bit. I just wanted to give this quote from Roger Ebert. He gave the film 3 out of 4 stars. Quote, the film's opening scenes are not great filmmaking. They're heavy on jargon and impenetrable calculation, murky and heavy on theory. My guess is that much of the fascination with this film is inspired by the unveiling of facts, unclearly seen. There's a whole lot of plot, basically just that Maya thinks that she's right, and she is. Which I thought was a very, like, it does have a 3X structure. But I think there's something that you said, Teresa, which is like it feels like chapters that makes this – and I think that the reason is that – and I think Ebert's like picking up on this – is that the film itself is just – you're just propelled into a main character story of she finds purpose and then she executes it. But there's no change. She doesn't go through change except maybe perhaps, which we'll talk about, the final
– the very end. Yeah.
And there's this kind of – you know, twist about her crying, which we can talk about. But, like, ultimately, there's no, like, hero's journey. So there's not a lot of plot. There's not a lot of things where the plot pushes back.
Right.
Osama, at the beginning of the film, is an enemy, and at the end of the film, is still an enemy.
It is interesting you say that about the hero's journey, because she also, whether or not she succeeds, I think... And you said there was a version of this where they didn't succeed, and I think you still get a strong idea of the character. I mean, it's more rewarding for us to see them succeed, but at the, like... because we end on her and her being alone and her dealing with, like, having succeeded, we see, like, oh, she doesn't change. Meaning, even if he didn't die, like, I would still have been interested in watching that movie because...
Yeah, it is.
Just watching her drive and just her obsession with it is what's interesting.
Right.
It's similar to The Hurt Locker in that way, and The Hurt Locker is not a hero's journey. It's just...
Yeah, I don't mean to say that she doesn't change, but I think just to be clear to the audience, like, it's clear that the plot doesn't push her back, you know, like most movies do.
Mm-hmm.
She's on one through line. Like, she's not, there's no typical, like, she makes actions that then set her back and she has to face the consequences.
Right.
She's mostly just, like Roger Ebert said, like, she's right.
And she is.
She's right.
She thinks she's right.
Yeah.
And she is.
She is.
So we talked about how the movie was made. Now we're going to talk about what the movie is actually about. Little things you may not have noticed. A little segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret thing. Sorry, that's how we do it here.
Love secret.
Yeah, symbolism you didn't notice. Talk about it.
All right, so Teresa, you mentioned earlier about Dan, who's Jason Clark's character, feeding the monkeys ice cream. There's a juxtaposition in the shot that introduces us to that sequence where you have all the detainees, human detainees, in cages out in the middle of the desert. Nobody's tending to them. They're all just standing in these single cages that are just lined up in a row. And then in the middle is Dan, Jason Clark. And then on the right is the cage of the monkeys. And he's being very tender and feeding the monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
And he and everyone else completely ignoring the human beings on the left.
Right. So it's like a misdirection kind of deal. It's like to say...
Well, so they're less than monkeys.
That could be an interpretation. I would argue, I don't know what you think about that, but like when as you presented it, what I took from it is that ultimately we're focusing on the wrong immorality, or we're focusing on the wrong, not the wrong, but like there are multiple injustices and we're focusing on a solution to all injustice or solution to a particular injustice in a roundabout way. You know, like we should be protecting fellow humans, mm-hmm. not to say that we shouldn't be, you know, helpful to monkeys, but like ultimately there's so much caging happening in the world that it's kind of like a backward kind of like you're focusing on the wrong thing, man.
Right. Yeah. And he's also boxed in too. Like yeah. The two sets of cages yeah. around him create a cage.
A cage. Yeah. That's good.
And I think it's I see that. I think it's a comment on where he is in his character.
Yeah.
Because he is, I mean, the very first scene we see him in, he's just a very brutal man.
Yeah.
And he clearly does view these detainees as subhuman because he has to in order to do his job. But then we do eventually see that it has taken its toll on him yeah. where he's like, I can't do this anymore.
It's like, yeah, it's like a postcard or a state of the union of his mm-hmm. character.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I kind of see it as both. Well, when I was watching it, I didn't notice. I mean, I guess that speaks to they want you to not really care about the people there. I didn't notice the people as much, but I think that you're right, Abe. It does feel like the monkeys being there are a way to say, like, as an audience, it's all subjective. Like, you care about the monkeys because yeah. they're making you care, and you don't care about these humans because you think, oh, they're just, like, bad guys.
They're out of sight, out of mind.
Right, and it's mm-hmm. subjective. Like, the government can make you feel certain ways about the enemy, even though, depending on what side you're on, like, the other side is also the enemy. Mm-hmm. But when I saw, when the monkeys steal the ice cream from him, to mm-hmm. me, I saw it as like, oh, you think he's safe because he's outside of the cage. But really, like, they're all, that's why I said, like, it all feels like they're all being tortured by having to torture. I mean, you think you have the power, but then, like, so easily the monkey takes it away and he's just like, okay. And yeah. he just gives it up and he's like, he's just as powerless. He's not right. in control and he is just as caged as them being on the outside. It all depends on what you want, right?
Yeah, and then we actually see that happen later with the other female agent mm-hmm. who gets the guy into their compound and like right. inside and their secure area, kills her, yeah. blows up, kills her, and kills a bunch of other people.
Yeah, yeah. If you want something that's inside a cage and you're outside of the cage, then you're the one that's trapped.
Yeah,
yeah. If you have the ability and you have the resources, you can lure anyone to anything. But you don't have control of
right,
what they
yeah,
do and, when they have it.
Yeah, and we do see that.
Which is, that's an analogy for the war, frankly.
Yeah, for a lot of things. Like, exactly what Teresa was saying. Like, even in the scenes when Dan is torturing that guy, he's not in control. He's not getting what he wants from the guy.
No, you see him feeling tortured by having to do that. And yeah. he's just like, just tell me the thing. And in a way, the guy is in pain, but he's holding back information. Like, in a way, he's actually more in control.
Yeah,
yeah. He has that little bit of information, and he knows as long as he hangs on to it. Even though they say, like, if you just give us this info, we'll be nicer to you. But, like, that's probably not true. He's also guilty of crimes. They'll probably kill
him
once
they... No, they'll toss him in a Guantanamo
Bay. Yeah, once they get what they want. So he knows, at least in this moment, it's like this... It's painful, but he'll stay alive, and he knows what that is. Mm-hmm. Once he gives the info, he could just die. Like, they don't need him anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It's obvious, but little black cat runs in front of the car when mm-hmm. she's waving it into the compound. So you're like, oh, well, some shit's about to go down.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Catherine Bigelow and cats.
She likes her cats.
As
cats,
in the Hurt Locker, you got the injured cats. It's kind of, she likes to make a narrative where it's like cats reflect where we're at, mm-hmm. you know.
And then there's also, you mentioned earlier, the fact that you can't tell any of the SEALs apart when they're in the middle of the mission. And I think that's another part of the sort of faceless idea of war that the movie presents. Like in the scene that I just mentioned with Dan in between the monkeys and the people who are the detainees in the cages,
yeah.
they're far off in the background and we never get like a close shot of them. So they're all faceless. Osama's never, mm-hmm. he's always obscured.
Yeah.
And then the SEALs are all obscured, and they literally look like monsters with
yeah.
those goggles, and they're just like these terrifying figures, even though they're national heroes, but they're even, like, we don't even know who those guys are.
Yeah, and to the people in the rooms, like, they're this terrifying,
yeah, they're imposing. Just these monsters. Yeah, right. They're coming in, like, they're like the kids are screaming, right. And they're like, no, it's okay, it's okay. And their parents are murdered 2 feet away.
Right.
It's like, no, it's not okay.
They're clearly not okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything.
And I assume, like, two of Osama's wives, at one point, they're, like, screaming and, like, clutching to his body as they rip them, mm-hmm. they rip them away.
And continue to shoot him.
Yeah.
Like, they and I mean, that's...
They're like, it's okay, he's a murderer.
Right, like, and it's, it becomes, like, there's a through line yeah. to the movie where she never says, Maya never says capture.
Yeah.
She always says, you're going to kill Osama for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, she's...
And they get there, and that's why, they're not there to apprehend.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, Chris Pratt shoots that one of the wives right. through the back.
Yeah.
Partially because she's kind of, her hands getting near the gun.
Yeah.
But also because they're there to kill.
Yeah.
And that's why when they neutralize the men, they then shoot them again on the ground because
to make sure they're
you
dead.
Make sure they're dead. Yeah. You're
absolute
not getting back up.
Certainty yeah. of threat. And I thought that it's actually like right after the actual physical killing, there's a scene where they're like regrouping in like a hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I didn't notice this, and I don't know if you guys noticed this, there's one line said in that sequence, which is one of the SEALs asks the guy who actually killed.
Oh, yeah.
He says, do you know what you just did?
That guy's shell-shocked.
Yeah, which is crazy because I think it's a double meaning. One is, do you know how great of a thing you just did like 15 seconds ago is? We mm-hmm. just killed Osama bin Laden. But it also is double to, did you realize that you just like outed a person's life? Like, so it's kind of a double hand.
You shot a man to
victory
death
and grief.
In a room full of children
yeah.
and his wives. And like, that soldier... Apart from, he's the only one that's featured apart from, like, the named actors like Chris
Edgerton.
Pratt and Joel Edgerton and Frank Grillo to a lesser degree. But he doesn't know how he feels about it.
Yeah.
Like, that guy represents kind of what we were talking about at the top of the podcast. Like,
yeah.
he's done this momentous thing in terms of culture and history, and he doesn't know how to feel about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's what the film as a whole is about, right? Namely, America's response to the Abu Ghraib photos in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the photos were released, we didn't know how to deal with it. We all witnessed our ability to essentially become the evil that we're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
While the film didn't exactly depict the truth of how we found bin Laden, it does give like some form of like catharsis, right?
Right.
And so Hollywood shows us this acceptable moral gray line of like, I guess, acceptable methods for victory. Like, it says, like, this is how you get victory. And we always have these Hollywood movies that are like, no, you do the right thing. You're Han Solo or you're Darth Vader. You know, like, you can be a scoundrel, but there's a line you don't cross. And in this mm-hmm. movie, we cross that line. So, but Bigelow, interestingly, avoids full shots of bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she does these kind of things where there's a grief and misery in the death.
Well, she
him.
Also does an interesting thing. Like you said, it's interesting you use the word victory because it didn't feel like a victory when
right.
they shoot bin Laden. Like,
yeah.
we know it's coming, but it's all, like, that whole sequence is so long and paced out evenly and, like, has all this tension. When they do shoot him, and they shoot other two guys before that, and you know it's coming, but there's no, like, swelling of music. There's no
nope.
build-up.
Yep.
It's not...
It's very sudden.
Yeah, it's not
very
shot like an action film where you get the boss. It's just shot... paced out like the other two kills, and it's just another one. But
they just kind of shoot him. Like,
yeah, that's
it's,
it. Yeah,
it's Chris Pratt does his Predator thing again, where he's like, Osama.
Yeah.
And then they get him to open the one of his wives open the door. They shoot her like
in
the
arm. Yeah.
And then they just shoot him.
Yeah.
And he's dead.
Yeah.
That's it.
And he's
like,
in bed.
There's no
and he's
fight.
Dead.
There's no.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a victory. It doesn't feel like a loss. It just feels like it happens. And then
yeah, there's
you're not supposed to feel anything about it.
What I think about her state. I think her true statement, if I were to argue anything, my argument would be it's about how revenge is never like truly relished. It's just
yeah.
only self-congratulatory.
It's just done because that's
we
the
need
thing
to.
We had to do.
There's
and
no.
we feel good about it because why? We were hurt, not because it was right.
Well, they also do, I think she does a good job of, like, like you said, showing both sides how they can both be the evil, because when they're interrogating the detainees in the first act, there's a lot of asking people to give up their friends, and I think one of the guys talks about how, like, oh, well, we were all together, you know, in the same sort of mission,
mm-hmm.
and she's like, oh, did you guys eat, like, who did you eat with, and you sort of get a sense of, like, they're not just war criminals, they were on a mission together, and then... I mean, yes, they did terrible things, but at the time they probably were like buddies with each other in an evil, you know, in an evil scheming way. But then at the end, when you see the seals all hanging out, you sort of see like, oh, well, this would one of these people give up their friends if they were being questioned?
Right, because
so
they're also
just hanging out and also on a mission to kill. So
which
if
is
one
a,
was
it's
captured,
illegal.
Right, like, and if one was captured, would they give up a name? So then you sort of see the other side of it.
And there's never a hero shot.
No.
She never does a hero shot of any of the seals in that.
There's no glory in it.
And even in the earlier scenes, like with Jason Clark and the interrogation scenes, never a hero shot of him.
No.
It's just
a steady operation of espionage.
You were talking about symbols earlier, and there was one I wanted to point out, which I don't know if it was on purpose, but I noticed it when towards the end they have a line about like human error. Oh, I think when Debbie brings the file in.
Yeah.
It just doesn't mean human error. And then the next scene they cut to is an emblem of the U.S. Embassy.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that.
I'm like, I don't know if that was on purpose.
No, it's like totally a juxtaposition.
Interesting.
You know? Yeah.
Cut in, cut out.
Yeah, definitely. Like we were saying, like the ugliness of war stuff, like even the people who are supposed to be the good guys are incredibly ruthless. Like Chris Pratt shoots that lady in the back. And then later when he tells him, yeah, I smoked the guy and his wife. And Edgerton's like, she dead? And he's like, probably bled out. But he doesn't care.
Yeah, clinical.
Yeah, he's just like. And then Maya wants to bomb the house.
Which has children.
They know it has children in it.
And women, yeah.
And that's probably specifically why Osama had so many children in the compound was to dissuade that sort of action. But Maya was like, I don't want to send you guys. Yeah. I wanted to bomb the place.
In fact, the one piece of information that leads her to believe 100%, as she says, that he's there is that there was like, oh, there's a third woman there. That means that there's a third male. So it's like the very factoid is that, you know, women and children exist.
Right.
And I'm using that against my enemy, which is a very anti, like, women and children first kind of, you know, Titanic sinking kind of. She does not care about that.
Yeah.
She just cares about winning.
Maybe that was a direct snub at her ex. Maybe. You care about women and children. I don't give a fuck. You don't care about me.
Fuck Titanic.
You don't care about women.
Fuck. Jimmy.
And, like, you were talking about Abu Ghraib and the movie as a response to the, you know, the quote unquote advanced interrogation discussion that was happening at the time. One of the chapters in the movie is called The Interview, which is sort of unclear until you realize that the characters are having a conversation in a conference room where an interview with Obama is playing in the background. And that's the interview where he said America does not engage in torture. So from that point on, they have to be like, you know, Jason Clark tells her, like, oh, we can't, you got to keep your head down now because they're going to be really looking at this stuff. Like, we can't.
Scrutiny's up.
The movie doesn't make, I still agree, I think we're all in agreement, the movie doesn't take a side, really. It doesn't make a definitive statement, but it does show that Jason Clark beating the hell out of the guy in the beginning doesn't do anything to prevent the attack on the hotel, you know, when the guys show up with AK-47s, just shoot everybody. And continued torture in the movie doesn't do anything to prevent the attacks that happen. But it does show that after that, it also shows that after the interview chapter, when the CIA sort of had to, you know, start keeping their head down, there's huge gaps in time now. Like before that moment in the film, the gaps in time between each like chapter or each like break in the case were like months.
Yeah.
After the interview, they become years. So you can also, the argument could also be inferred from that is that abandoning torture slowed the hunt for Osama to a crawl and possibly also allowed for more.
Yeah, and that's the sequence where she was writing the number on the window.
Yep, that part, and then also just, I think the bus bombing happens in that span of time.
Yeah, but it's like, that's the question of war. It's hard to say what you don't know, right? Like, it's like, is torture wrong because they're people? And then in hindsight, we see that there's all these other people that die. Like, would you torture one person to save those people? Some people might say yes, and some people would say no because you don't know for sure those people are going to die, right? There's no way to know. It's uncertain if there's going to be an attack. Even if you know it's coming, you might be able to stop it, right? That's why we try to, I mean, our useless TSA, but like we try to put security measures in place to attempt to stop these kinds of attacks.
Yeah, and that's a line, I think Jason Clark says it in the movie.
Like, we have to.
He says, we don't know what we don't know.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And then, Friday Night Lights is immediately like, what the fuck does that mean?
Kyle Chandler?
Kyle Chandler, yeah.
Yeah. Friday Night Lights.
Hot dad.
Hot dad.
Clear eyes. It's interesting because as we're talking about the character Maya, something you brought up, which was that she has no purpose outside of hunting. You mentioned that the CIA director asked, what else has she done? And she says nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
Yeah. And she has no friends.
She has no friends. That's the whole, we joked a lot about it at the beginning, but she says, when she's like emphatically, look, no, I don't fuck. Yeah. Like that is just hammering home the point that she has no connection to any other human being.
And that's
she doesn't have any friends. She's not romantically involved with anybody. Her whole life is this pursuit.
And that's a harrowing statement on success. Like, there was actually another film that, like, for some reason we've decided Jessica Chastain is this character. Because I don't know if you guys saw Miss Sloane.
Oh, no.
She plays
this. Yeah.
Yeah, it's essentially the same, not the same character, but she is just methodical and has no friends and has not, like, she is just a lobbyist and she just fucking rules at lobbying.
Yeah. And that's an old cliche, too. It's like you have to choose between your. If you want to succeed or if you want to have like a fulfilling family or emotional life.
It seems to be an interesting thing that Bigelow herself, even though, as you mentioned, it's cliche, she does that with her female characters quite a bit. You know, like there's a bit of like, in order to win, you have to like hunker down and like, you know, fight in this man's world. And I think that that's probably true to her experience, perhaps.
Possibly, yeah. Definitely for this character, because when it's all done and she gets in the belly of that big-ass airplane, he's like, guy's like, oh, you got the whole plane to yourself? You must be really important. She cries.
Yeah.
Because there's nobody there with her to share the victory.
Which I think isn't, like, I think when we all left that scene, I don't know, just for
there's
me,
a couple of
least,
ways to interpret
there's
it.
There's so many different ways to interpret it, and I don't know which one is right, and I still don't know.
They
is
could she, all be true.
Is she thankful it's over? Is she crying because she now only realizes that she murdered someone? I don't think it's that one as much because it's been her whole charge, but it might be, you know?
I think they could all be true. It could be relief that it's over. It could be sort of, oh, I've finally done this thing, and
right.
It didn't feel the way I thought it was going to feel.
Or even that it's over and I'm crying because now I no longer have a purpose.
Yeah,
like
now it, she has
crying
to go
for
back
the aftermath
to DC
and I don't want to do that. I had this thing.
Like, what's your doesn't know? She has never done anything else, so she doesn't know what her life is outside of this.
My hot take, even though I think, as we all said, it's kind of ambiguous, is that I think she's crying because the retribution is not as sweet as she thought it would be. Just because I think that that's like the line that precedes it is essentially like. All right, you're done.
Yeah.
And in the same way that everything about this film is clinical, she expected more of a, you know, fanfare. Because
I don't know
it's such
if she
a,
does.
Like, it's her only moment where she's congratulated.
But she doesn't feel like that kind of person. She doesn't feel like someone who's doing anything for glory.
Right.
Like, she doesn't even, although there, she does have that one scene where she's like, I'm the motherfucker that found this. So maybe in the back of her mind, she does want someone to acknowledge her, but yeah, she doesn't. It reads almost to me as she just has this thing, and she's like, "I have to do it because I said I would," and there's no like, "Oh, once I do it, then I'm gonna fuck." Like, there's no like, there's no other motivation besides.
She's
like,
never been thinking beyond that.
Yeah,
point.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, which might be, maybe that's it. I don't know. The audience maybe can decide.
Yeah. All right. We've talked about some of the hidden. Mise-en-scene, I guess.
Mise-en-scene
of the film. Now let's talk about some scenes that maybe should have been in the movie that could have enhanced or ruined it in spectacular fashion in a segment we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed.
Ooh, yeah.
After they land back at the base with Bin Laden's body, I'd like to say, I would like to see a brief scene where they just say, man, I guess we really didn't need the dog. Sorry to drag you and Bazooka all the way out here, Chet. Like... Because I'm sure there is a very, because I'm obviously not in the military, I'm sure there's a very specific function that dog was meant to serve.
Probably bomb
didn't do it.
Yeah.
Whatever it was there to do, it was just kind of this guy leading this dog around. So I just want a scene where they're like,
bring out the dog.
Man, I guess we didn't need the dog this time. But I mean,
I'm sure.
Good thing he was there.
I mean, and I'm sure the dog was like real pissed off about that. Like,
yeah.
You brought me out of bed.
I mean, the dog's having a blast.
Yeah, that's probably
but,
true.
Yeah.
It's going to get some treats after.
I guess it'd be funny to see, like, Maya try to date, like, if she goes back
like a,
just on a date, and they're like, how... Or,
the yeah, oh, the just, epilogue
like,
scene.
Like, that epilogue, which yeah. is like, I'm going to be normal now. Because I feel like she's also the kind of person who tries to do things because she's supposed to. So if someone's like, well, now you got to do this, she'll be like, all right. And then she'll just be on a date and like, so tell me about yourself. Oh, I killed Osama.
Yeah.
I'm,
like,
I'm okay. the one who made
and
it
she
happen.
Could never, yeah. like, she can, nobody can ever win an argument with her. Like, her future husband or wife is just always going to have to give in. Yeah. Like, right. I will fight you for 10 years until I get dirt on you. And
you
then
realize I have the most constitution of anyone on earth.
Right.
That's true. She can't function in society.
I feel like her epilogue would be very similar to James's in The Hurt Locker. Where he's lost in a grocery store.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't know what to do here.
Yeah, having her at Starbucks get her drink messed up. She's just like, I know what I ordered. I'm right.
I'm always
begins
right.
a 10-year manhunt.
Did you
on
do
the barista
you know
that
I
fucked
am?
Up her coffee?
Yeah, that's like villain shit right there. So let's make some weird non-intuitive arguments about the movie in a segment we call Let's Overthink It. Tom.
Yeah. All right, so nobody's lights start coming on until well after the SEALs have breached Bin Laden's compound. You think the lights would have come on when the helicopter crashed in his backyard?
Yeah,
it's like
wasn't
a gigantic helicopter. It crashes in the middle of their neighborhood.
Right.
They're making all the noise in the universe, like blowing the doors off the place.
Right.
Like, you figure more lights have been clicked on.
Yeah, because like, I mean, I assume, you know, like in a wartime area, like, helicopters are a normal occurrence, but not crashed.
Not a crash, and not a series of explosions.
They said, like, oh, these helicopters are so quiet. I'm like, how quiet can a helicopter be?
There's only so quiet. Like, they're quieter.
Yeah. Also, why don't they have this? They're protecting Osama bin Laden. Why don't they have guns in there? I imagine
they
have
some
weapons,
guns.
Right?
I think they
nobody
do.
Came out and, like, tried to
oh,
shoot.
I think
they
the
did.
Argument
oh,
is
they
so
yeah,
that
yeah.
they don't look like a, you know, like a fortress,
away.
Because that would give away who's
yeah,
there.
Osama didn't have a gun, but the first two guys definitely did.
They
remember,
definitely
they tried
they
to get in
so
the compound,
guard,
he starts
I
shooting
see.
Through the door.
It was, like, low-key protected.
Yeah. Like, the protection, most of the protection was the secrecy of it.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's true that I feel like there's other ways to just, like, all right, just, like, hide a bunch of guns, though, you know?
Like, maybe just bury him. Like, because they talk about, like, oh, he always goes underneath this grape orchard or whatever it was.
Right.
Like, a bunch of leaves that can't, like, the satellites can't penetrate. Just keep the guns there.
Yeah. But who's to say? I think, I mean, there's arguably it was very relatable to the actual events. So there could have been other circumstances that are outside of the film that made it, you know, that's how it actually went down. Who's to say?
What about Debbie? You guys mentioned that earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Was she an intern? Oh, she was just...
Yeah, the logic... that scene is baffling. Like,
she's
when she's
magical.
Well, she's like, this guy is I forgot the...
something.
Ibrahim?
Ibrahim is... And I forgot his, like...
Abu
Ahmed, maybe? Yeah.
Yeah.
She's like, this guy is him, and let me tell you why. And fucking nothing she says makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It's like, how did you get from A to B on that one?
She's just like, trust me, I got the paperwork, man.
Yeah.
And Maya's just like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking for, so I'm going to believe it 100%.
Well, and then she makes the connection about, like, they're eight brothers and they look the same.
But
even that's
a lot
like,
of hearsay.
Yeah, it's, and I'm sure that's just another example of, like, diluting a bunch of investigation down into one character for the purposes of making a movie and moving the movie forward. But it's this fucking magic intern who we never see before and never see again comes in and is like, I solved it. I cracked this nut. Like,
actually, I want to go back. That's the bonus scene. I want to see where, like, Deb is just watching, like, Maya take credit for all this shit. And she's like, motherfucker.
Deb needs something.
Yeah.
Deb.
So we're done here, but we want to talk about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Please hit us up with your thoughts, people. We have been Abe, Tom, and Teresa. Teresa.
Yeah.
Where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Larissa T, LeResatee. I host a comedy show in West Hollywood if you're in LA. It's free, called Very Forward at Bar Lubitsch on September 17th. So come to that.
Very
Do it.
Funny. Very funny human.
Bring your Deb stories.
Bring your Deb stories and Well, we've been honored that you joined us. Next week, we're going to be talking about 1991's Point Break, which will be our first live show.
Yeah.
Carmen Angelica and Soren Bowie will be there, along with a live studio audience. So look forward to that.
Yeah, man.
Commenters, tweet, or Facebook message us about which directors you want us to cover. We listen. That's it. Watch on, Movie Table.
Hey, guys. I wanted to check back in with you to tell you about the new Paramount Pictures film, Mother. A couple's relationship is tested when uninvited guests arrive at their home, disrupting their tranquil existence. From filmmaker Darren Aronofsky, who you probably know from Black Swan, Requiem for a Dream, The Wrestler, other really intense, really cerebral movies. Mother stars Jennifer Lawrence, Javier Bardem, Ed Harris, and Michelle Pfeiffer, and a riveting psychological thriller about love, devotion, and sacrifice. So go see it in theaters September 15th.
I'm H. Michael Cray.
And I'm Cuckoo Kulapilayasak, and we are the host of Who Charted, where we discuss the charts and pop culture and get to know our guests. Speaking of great guests, last week we had the wonderful Jason Manzoukas.
I'm so excited about this one. I can't wait for everybody to hear it. We had such a good time with Jason. We spoke of all his work in movie and films, and we had a great time counting down the charts.
So make sure you listen to us on Who Charted.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.